As all sides staked out new positions, the advisory committee's recommendations became meat for negotiation and maneuver. Although Russell was mortally wounded by the Proposition U debacle, losing her once impregnable seat in November 1987 to slow-growth advocate Ruth Galanter, she and Garcia tried to deal themselves back into the game by embracing the Community Planning Board proposal without the elected members. Browdy and Yaroslavsky, the slow-growth heroes of the day, countered with a detailed follow-up to Proposition U's broad plan, an ordinance that would allow the city to review any project of 50,000 square feet, the size of an ordinary supermarket, or more. Finally, Mayor Bradley, silent or acting by proxy through most of the Proposition U commotion, directed a major speech in April 1988 toward the slow-growth movement. Promising to arrest mini-mall blight and protect hillside neighborhoods, he endorsed the principle of community participation in planning, but was characteristically vague about the composition of the boards and whether or not the city needed the kind of detailed environmental review powers advocated by Browdy and Yaroslavsky. For the Hillside Federation, however, empowerment of the community planning boards was the decisive issue. In their view, the embittering generation-long experience of community participation in impotent planning exercises had erased any doubt about the need for root-and-branch reform. The principal achievement of Proposition U was that it had at last produced a citizens' planning constituency. The Federation rejected the pygmy version of participation, which appointed token homeowners to advisory boards top-heavy with developers and their agents. Instead, they demanded completely elected community planning boards of local residents meeting in town hall fashion and invested with implementation power that could only be overridden by a 4/5 majority of the City Planning Commission. 20 years of political bad faith, in other words, had driven George Wills's Sunbelt Bolsheviks to call for homeowners Soviets. That, at least, was how it looked to horrified building industry executives, whose fears were not entirely without foundation. In advocating the devolution of land use control to communities, the Federation was certainly raising one of the most radical demands in Southern California since the days of EPIC, or Ham and Eggs, in the 1930s. The Black Panther Party's famous call in the 1960s for community policing seemed meek in comparison to the Federation's plan for neighborhoods to exercise the rights of screening development and regulating local real estate markets. Moreover, some hillside enragés like Gerald Silver of the Homeowners of Encino saw community planning merely as a prelude to zip code federalism, break up the city into smaller, more manageable units. But whether or not the whole Federation fully appreciated the ideological implications of its stand, it had determined to make community planning the main issue in the aftermath of Proposition U. The defeat of Russell had ended the era of invincible pro-growth rule on the council, and homeowners counted on her successor, Ruth Galanter, to become the standard-bearer of their demand for elected boards. An environmental planner from a new left background, but owing her election to massive support from the Federation and local homeowner groups, Galanter seemed the freshest and most iconoclastic face on the city council in decades. Moreover, her enthusiasm for elected boards was so much taken for granted that no one paid any heed when, at a Hillside Federation forum on community planning, she sat smiling silently through the discussion at hand. The meaning behind her Mona Lisa smile was revealed a few weeks later, when she voted with the rest of the council for appointed planning boards strictly subordinate to council members. A Federation leader gasped, "She blew us out of the water. It was Pat Russell all over again." Repudiating the Federation's radical vision of community sovereignty, the council did, after a fashion, decentralize planning power, but only to itself. Grasping at the power to broker growth on a district level through puppet planning boards, individual council members, however, still remained under intense pressures to deal with homeowner anger against commercial development. By the summer of 1987, a structure of accommodation had emerged whereby Westside and Valley council members were supporting each other's manipulation of the city's interim control law to pacify constituents' land use grievances. A crazy quilt of 50 interim control ordinances, temporary moratoria on specific kinds of building, gave short-term relief to complaints by homeowners associations about mini-malls, hillside developments, apartment density, mobile home parks, and the like. At the same time, the ordinances acted to keep homeowners in Los Angeles away from the ballot box and to demobilize citywide protest into local supplication. This was exactly what Dan Garcia, now teamed up with Citizen Advisory Committee leader Dan Shapiro, advocated. The slow growth movement should in the future avoid citywide solutions to all local problems, and instead should focus attention on community and neighborhood planning and controls. Meet Act's approaches that stop all development or that do not permit individual community planning would simply further the polarization process. But just as the neo-feudalism of the city council seemed on the verge of dispersing Los Angeles's slow growth movement into benign parochialism, 50 million gallons of raw sewerage unexpectedly hit the proverbial fan. The Hyperion Factor. Hyperion, what joy the place would have brought to those passionately prosaic lovers of humanity, Chadwick and Bentham. The problem of keeping a great city clean without polluting a river or fouling the beaches, and without robbing the soil of its fertility, has been triumphantly solved. Aldous Huxley. As Huxley recalled it, a few months before the outbreak of World War II, he and Thomas Mann were walking along the south shore of Santa Monica Bay, miraculously alone and wrapped in discussion of Shakespeare, when they suddenly realized that as far as the eye could reach in all directions, the sand was covered with small whitish objects like dead caterpillars. The caterpillars were, in fact, Malthusian flotsam. 10 million used condoms, Huxley estimated, washed back on shore from Los Angeles's main sewer outfall at Hyperion Beach. Without recording his famous companion's reaction to this bizarre sight, Huxley contrasted the scene on the same beach 15 years later. The sands are now clean, children dig, well-basted sunbathers slowly brown, etc. This happy consummation had been brought about by one of the marvels of modern technology, the Hyperion Activated Sludge Plant. In an otherwise ironic essay about hygiene and class distinction, Huxley took for granted that Hyperion really was the triumphant solution to an ancient urban problem. Indeed, other writers have evoked the euphoric feeling of this grand coulee of sewerage plants, which transforms the waste of 3 million people into what has been described as the largest freshwater stream in Southern California. All the more fitting, therefore, that the preeminent symbol of Los Angeles's supposedly infinite ability to manipulate nature for the sake of development should become the grim anti-hero of the city's environmental crisis of the late 1980s. The breakdown of Marvelous Hyperion in late May 1987 gushed millions of gallons of unspeakable waste into Santa Monica Bay, defiling beaches and inflaming local tempers. It was the first of a tragicomic succession of eco-disasters that overwhelmed the Bradley administration in 1987-8 and gave slow growth the fillip of pre-apocalyptic common sense. As shit was followed by floodwater, drought, toxics, seismic activity, smog, and solid waste, the horrible penny began to drop in City Hall that the growth wars between homeowners and developers were actually being fought within the limits of a collapsing infrastructure. At first, it seemed that Los Angeles could save itself simply by sticking a gilded finger in the dike at Hyperion, a $2.3 billion renovation. But anxious engineering reports to the mayor immediately leaked to the press revealed that the entire system was on the verge of collapse. As the Times caustically observed, planning procedures have been so slack that nobody made the most basic connection between population growth and the carrying capacity of a sewage system. Although the old trunk sewers were large enough to accommodate the 10 million gallons of new flow added each year by urbanization, the treatment plants had exhausted their capacity. The mayor's attempt to abate the crisis through voluntary water conservation was ignored, especially in affluent, slow-growth West Side and Valley neighborhoods, with their swimming pools and acre-sized lawns. A crash program to expand the crucial Tillman sewage plant in the Sepulveda Basin of the Los Angeles River then ran afoul of the Army Corps of Engineers, custodians of Los Angeles's flood control system. They warned the city that the Tillman expansion would critically reduce the basin's capacity to retain floodwater, a serious issue in light of the Corps' recent exhaustive re-study of the city's flood control defenses. The city's original prime amenity, the lovely meandering Los Angeles River, had been sacrificially transformed into an ugly concrete storm sewer in the 1940s in order to protect adjoining real estate from the periodic flood menace. Now, the Corps' study revealed, unforeseen levels of new development were not only producing intolerable volumes of sewage, but through adding tens of thousands of additional acres of road surface and rooftop, a 40% increase in storm runoff that threatened new catastrophic floods. Moreover, the interconnections of the situation were such that additional sewage capacity at Tillman would encourage more growth in the valley, which would in turn increase runoff and by doing so make Tillman even more susceptible to flooding. Hard on the heels of these exposés of the city's failing sewer and flood control systems came disturbing reports of disastrous groundwater contamination potentially affecting 40% of the water supply. The infiltration of industrial solvents and other toxic chemicals had already forced the closure of 150 wells, and officials confessed that it would take 3 decades and at least $2 billion to flush out the polluted aquifers. Critics claimed this was a drastic underestimate and predicted that cleanup costs could run as high as a staggering $40 billion. But water, in any case, was becoming scarcer as a protracted drought escalated the water wars that pitted Southern California against Northern California and Arizona. As the withdrawal of Los Angeles Aqueduct water from the Mono Basin on the eastern flank of the Sierras threatened a local ecological catastrophe, Los Angeles water authorities debated the unsavory last resort of purchasing water allotments from Central Valley agribusiness, now water ranchers. Meanwhile, Los Angeles's deadline for compliance with the 1970 Federal Clean Air Act expired. Pleading with Washington for a quarter-century extension, the city conceded defeat in its 30-year war against air pollution, which remained by far the worst in the advanced industrial world. All the hard-won gains from the enforcement of mandatory smog control devices had been more than offset by population growth and increased density of auto ownership. Moreover, the housing affordability crisis, which was forcing hundreds of thousands of workers to commute from distant interior valleys, was inexorably driving up mileage and generating gridlock on the suburban fringes. A chilling February 1988 study from the Southern California Association of Governments warned that if population and job housing trends continued at present levels, $110 billion in new freeway construction would be needed just to stabilize existing congestion. In lieu of this investment, growing gridlock was expected to reduce average freeway speeds to sub-horse and buggy velocities, about 15 miles per hour, by the end of the 1990s. Contributing to the slowdown would be the thousands of dump trucks needed to transport the city's solid waste into the desert or beyond, as existing landfills in a 5-county area reached capacity in the early 1990s. As each crisis implied others to come, it was difficult for City Hall to pretend these were unrelated contingencies and not the falling dominoes of overdevelopment, as predicted by slow-growth forces. Mayor Bradley, in particular, had to face inexorably mounting pressures to declare a temporary halt to new development. Even before the Hyperion spill, Assemblyman Tom Hayden, Democrat Santa Monica, had allied slow growth with the environmental defense of Santa Monica Bay by demanding a strict limit on new construction until sewage capacity was increased. After the May spill vindicated Hayden, he was joined by Westside Congressman Mel Levine, as well as by Proposition U authors Browdy and Yaroslavsky, in threatening to call in the Environmental Protection Agency to save the bay. The hitherto unimaginable specter of federal environmental receivership, a threat renewed in summer 1988 after the city failed to comply with clean air standards, was the shotgun that forced Mayor Bradley into a reluctant wedding with growth control forces. He began the courtship in July 1987 when he withdrew the city's opposition to the Friends of Westwood decision. This important legal victory for slow-growth activists found that the city had erred in not requiring an environmental impact report on a 26-story Wilshire Boulevard high-rise. The mayor shocked his pro-growth supporters by accepting the environmental review of all major developments, the gist of the follow-up ordinance to Proposition U that Browdy and Yaroslavsky had earlier proposed. Then, in early December 1987, after officially recognizing that the sewer system had reached breakdown point, Bradley boldly unveiled his own 10-point plan that included a monthly cap on new construction based on sewer capacity. Yaroslavsky chortled, "I'm pleased that the mayor has come around to my way of thinking." The cap was designed to apply not only to Los Angeles, but because of the city's authority as sewer landlord, to the 30 other municipalities contracting its sewer treatment facilities. A draconian consequence was that the city's currently pumping more sewage into the system than their quotas allowed, including Santa Monica, Burbank, and San Fernando, were faced with a total growth freeze. While developers and builders watched in dismay, some of Bradley's most trenchant critics, including Tom Hayden, rallied to his side in what seemed to be a rehearsal for a major political realignment. City Hall, however, was not greened in a day, even under the influence of Mike Gage, the eco-thinking deputy mayor. During the 1988 campaigns, Bradley managed to badly undermine his credibility as a born-again environmentalist and infuriate West Side homeowners anew by reneging on his historic opposition to Palisades oil drilling. Meanwhile, his sewer cap was stalled for a half year in the council while jealous members, all too aware that even temporary controls would become sacred cows, wrestled with the mayor over whether they themselves or the Board of Public Works, which he appointed, would exercise the power to ration new development and make individual exemptions. In the end, the mayor was forced to yield the prerogative to the council, who, after excluding key megaprojects dear to their hearts and pocketbooks, finally approved, in May 1988, a 9-month trial run of the most restrictive growth control since the Second World War. 2 years later, a renewed version of this stopgap ordinance was still in place, but now described as Phase 1 of a comprehensive growth management strategy. However prosaic a sewer ordinance may seem, it constituted an important, possibly epical, punctuation mark in the city's post-war history. The moment when the big boom finally had to take the Hyperion factor into account. Land use writer William Fulton described the ordinance as a stunning coup for slow-growth activists, whose cause was invested with mainstream region-wide political legitimacy. It was more significant than Proposition U because it set a precedent for regional growth controls, as the mayor of Los Angeles became the lever to shut off development in Santa Monica and Burbank. Skeptical slow-growth activists like Laura Lake of Not Yet New York, inured to wonderful plans and laws of the city that it violates every day, were not so sure they had won such a historic victory, and downplayed the significance of the city's newfound environmental zeal. Yet the Bradley administration, moving ever greenward as it bailed itself out from one political corruption crisis to another, continued in theory to commit itself to tougher growth management and conservationist positions. Thus, in April 1990, the mayor unveiled an official environmental primer, written in a startlingly Sierra Club idiom, that co-opted almost the entirety of mainstream eco-critiques previously directed against City Hall. Acknowledging a city at the limits as it reviewed one crisis after another, the primer declared that the days of the high-tech quick fix are numbered and proposed a tough cop role for the city as environmental enforcer. Amongst many militant-sounding recommendations, the primer urged an all-out municipal mobilization to support the South Coast Air Quality Management District's, AQMD, aggressive regional air quality management plan. Many developers now fear that the AQMD, with support from Los Angeles, may become the toughest slow-growth cop of them all. It is ironic that 12 white male political appointees a majority of whom presumably espouse the Republican creed of maximum deregulation, have undertaken to impose the most comprehensive peacetime regulation of local economic activity since the days of Roosevelt's Blue Eagle. Acting in the face of a federal ultimatum, in March 1989, the AQMD's Board of Governors, which does include slow-growth patriarch Browdy, adopted a sweeping 20-year plan to restore clean air in the Los Angeles Basin by 2007. Although developers and industrialists led by the giant Watson Land Company, developers of LA's new South Bay Industrial and Commercial Complex, howled in protest at proposed regulations to cover every species of air pollution from refinery fumes to underarm deodorants, their real vehemence was reserved for the AQMD's decision in early 1990 to systematically review all large-scale developments in the basin. When the AQMD leveled unprecedented criticism at developer Nathan Chappelle's $2 billion Porter Ranch Leviathan in the northern foothills of the valley, the biggest single mixed-use project in Los Angeles history, the ranch's spokesman, ex-planning commission boss Dan Garcia, and ex-bus stop leader Paul Clark, accused the district of declaring war on local decision-making. Developers, industrialists, and pro-growth LA supervisors then retaliated by introducing a bill in the state Senate that would allow businesses to use initiative and referendum processes to veto AQMD regulations. This emergent war of position between the green branches of government and the private sector, and between non-elected environmental managers and local pork barrel politicos, is reshaping both the language in which the politics of growth are articulated and the terrain on which different interests contend. In the wake of Hyperion, a third camp, the moderate growth management ideology of regional technocrats, has arisen between the righteous anger of the suburbs and the haughty indifference of the developers and their political henchmen. It only remains to see how homeowner activists in the suburban valleys have risen to the challenge of this new conjecture. NIMBYs and Know-Nothings. From a handful of dog lovers with pooper scoopers at the park, Jane, Perse's Park Watch has grown to a citywide group of 1,000 families, with a certified accountant and enough clout to get former Vice President Walter Mondale to support their cause. In November, officials approved a pilot program to have designated times and places for dogs to run without leashes. Councilman Joel Wax, who opposed the group from his district for years, voted for the plan. "He had no choice," said Joan Lux of Park Watch, who said 100 members of the group flooded a committee meeting. They made signs depicting Wax as the Antichrist, one of the Three Stooges, and a dog Nazi. Despite the immensity of Los Angeles's environmental crisis, it is hard to find evidence that the suburban slow-growth movement has understood its appointment with destiny. Indeed, as the tale of Park Watch's epic struggle for a pooper-scooperless dog park in the valley suggests, the essence of the contemporary suburban worldview is precisely the inability to distinguish the historical significance of the sewage clogging Santa Monica Bay from the precious pile deposited by Rover in his favorite dog park. A California neologism of the 1980s perfectly encapsulates this ethos of untranscendable parochialism: NIMBY. This means not in my backyard, although, as we shall see, not on my lawn is sometimes the better translation. In the particular case of San Fernando Valley homeowners, the big unitary issues of the late 1970s, taxes, busing, and density, were supplanted in the late 1980s by an exotic welter of NIMBY protests against traffic congestion, mini-mall development, airport expansion, school siting, the demolition of the Tale O'Cock restaurant, the erection of a mosque, an arts park, subdivision and apartment construction, road widening, the shaving of a hillside, diamond lanes, trailers for the homeless, the disappearance of horse stables, and the construction of a tortilla factory. Not even the rich and famous could sneak a drug treatment center, or a pee behind a bush, past the vigilance of valley homeowners. Faced with the prospect of the Lakeview Terrace Homeowners Association picketing their Bel Air mansion, The ex-First Lady was forced to say no to plans for the Nancy Reagan Drug Treatment Center in a vacant medical building in the Valley neighborhood. Meanwhile, the proposed Ventura Boulevard branch of a Tony Beverly Hills bistro sparked a vehement homes versus urinals battle with the Sherman Oaks Homeowners Association. Opposing the eatery's liquor permit at a zoning hearing, the homeowners elaborated their fear. The urine on the street, people don't think that the well-to-do would urinate in public or do other crude things. It's shocking, but it's true. To this monstrous allegation, the representative of Haute Cuisine replied, "We have been here in Beverly Hills for 25 years. We have had heads of state, movie stars, presidents, governors, princes, and princesses. To even suggest that any of these would urinate on someone's lawn before they step into their Mercedes is shocking. I think that people who are saying those kinds of things are living in a trashy neighborhood. Our bathrooms are probably more elegant than their living rooms." When it comes to solving major urban problems, moreover, the Valley homesteaders are about as patient and constructive as Sendero Luminoso. Ironically, the one big valley-wide issue in 1987-8 was opposition to a proposed light rail commuter line to downtown. The Valley's nightmarish traffic problems are symptomatic of the overall crisis of LA's growth infrastructures. With the smog-shrouded Ventura Freeway in rigor mortis due to the nation's worst congestion, excess traffic clogs arterial boulevards before spilling over into residential streets. Caltrans engineers have warned that without a quick fix of mass transit, the system isn't going to break down, it's going to explode. With a traffic apocalypse imminent, it might have been expected that Valley residents would have welcomed the LA County Transportation Commission's plan for cheap fixed rail transit. Instead, organized Valleyites were NIMBY homeowners first, and harassed commuters second. The commission, like previous outside agencies, failed to comprehend the neighborhood geography of the Valley and the fierce localisms disguised by a superficially homogeneous landscape. The proposed light rail route was plotted along Chandler Boulevard, unwittingly through the center of an Orthodox Jewish community, who protested that the line would disrupt Sabbath worship. The Hasidim were reinforced by other homeowner groups who saw the route as a conspiracy by Warner Center and Van Nuys business interests, who want to develop, develop, develop at the sacrifice of the American dream. Ultimately, Encino homeowners leader Jerry Silver, whose brother Bob lives on Chandler Boulevard, pulled together 100 other homeowners groups into the All Valley Transit Coalition, AVTC, to oppose light rail in anybody's backyard. As incredulous traffic engineers looked on, the powerful Transportation Commission crumbled in the face of NIMBY multiplied by 100. Although polls indicated that potential users overwhelmingly approved the proposed line, there was no grassroots organization of commuters. As Silver explained, people don't organize to fight for something, but they organize to fight against something. Rather than embroil themselves further with AVTC, a supersized version of Park Watch or West Hills, the Transportation Commission unheroically abandoned the field. 2 years later, after arduous negotiations with homeowners groups, legislators announced a compromise that would extend Metro Rail underground beneath Chandler Boulevard at immensely greater cost than the original light rail proposal, but without disturbing the Sabbath. The current helter-skelter of homeowner protest in the San Fernando Valley becomes more racially charged further east in the San Gabriel Valley, where slow-growth politics act as a latter-day version of anti-immigrant know-nothingism. Although Los Angeles County's other great suburban valley has roughly the same population as the San Fernando, approximately 1,250,000 in 1985, it is fragmented into a complex class, ethnic, and land use mosaic of 28 separately incorporated municipalities and numerous county wholes. Once the world's greatest citrus belt, the San Gabriel Valley, like the San Fernando, has been subjected to acute growth stress over the last generation. In the built-out western half of the valley, dominated by Pasadena, where land values rose 30% in 1987-8 alone, Established homeowners associations have fought fanatically to protect their single-family neighborhoods from desecration at the hands of apartment builders. Meanwhile, in the valley's rapidly urbanizing eastern half, especially along the growth corridor of the Pomona Freeway, which gained almost 250,000 new residents in the 1980s, commuter suburbanites have organized to slow development and preserve their remaining rural amenities. Across the San Gabriel Valley, however, these stock-and-trade slow-growth issues have become hopelessly conflated with an increasingly virulent racial backlash. Once predominantly Anglo with scattered colonias of Mexican citrus workers, the valley has become a major destination for upwardly mobile Chicanos leaving East LA and Chinese entrepreneurs arriving from Taiwan and Hong Kong, as well as for poorer Mexicans and Vietnamese. Whereas the 250,000 Chicanos, primarily blue-collar craftsmen and professionals, are perceived primarily as a political threat to entrenched Anglo power structures, the 150,000 Chinese, businessmen and developers, as well as professionals and workers, are resented for their alleged role in overdeveloping and physically degrading whole communities. Monterey Park, a San Gabriel Valley city of 65,000 residents about 8 miles east of downtown LA, has for nearly a decade been the major battlefield between white homeowners and growth with an Asian face. 90% Anglo in 1960, this hilly single-family suburb evolved during the 1970s toward an uneasy triadic balance of Anglo, Chicano, and Japanese-American residents, until Fred Say, a canny real estate promoter with offshore banking connections, conceived the idea of selling Monterey Park as the Chinese version of the California Dream. Beguiled by slick advertisements depicting a Chinese Beverly Hills, thousands of Mandarin speakers from Taiwan and Cantonese speakers from Hong Kong and Indonesia transformed Monterey Park into North America's first Chinese-majority suburb by 1985. A $500 million of diaspora capital shaped Atlantic Boulevard into an overscaled strip of Chinese office buildings and inundated the city planning department with scores of applications to build mini-malls and condominiums. This extraordinary ethnic restructuring produced a nativist backlash in the form of the RAMP, the Residents Association of Monterey Park, whose self-declared aim is slow growth, particularly the restriction of new multiple-unit and commercial construction. Since most of the developers opposed by RAMP are also Chinese, RAMP has invariably assumed the alter ego of being the main opposition to further Chinese takeover. In the 1986 elections, taking advantage of the fact that the city's white minority is still a larger registered voting bloc than the new Chinese majority, RAMP swept away moderate ethnic harmonizers, two Latinos and a Chinese-American, in favor of its own hardcore representatives. As sociologist John Horton explains, the struggle over land use control quickly became a fight over the very definition of what constitutes an American community. This nativist side of slow growth showed itself in 1985 when the city council adopted an ordinance requiring Chinese businesses to include English translations on their signage. A year later, at 1:30 a.m., after the watchful public had gone home, the council's slow growth majority pushed through a resolution supporting English as the official language of Monterey Park. One of the more patriotic council members even proposed that the local police cooperate with the INS in enforcing its American duties. Monterey Park's slow-growth know-nothingism reached its lowest point in the reign of Mayor Barry Hatch, an ex-Mormon missionary who attracted national notoriety for the table-thumping charge that a billion Chinese are looking for a soft place to land. There's nowhere else but here. The whole valley is what they want. Although Yellow Peril Hatch was finally evicted from the council by a rainbow mobilization of Chinese, Japanese, and Chicano voters in April 1990, RAMP-type groups had already spread throughout neighboring communities. For instance, one RAMP missionary had successfully lobbied conservative Republican homeowner leaders in San Gabriel, Arcadia, and six other cities facing Asian immigration to form a San Gabriel Valley slow-growth coalition with exclusionary undertones. The 1990 census will undoubtedly reveal that Alhambra, an older, more modest suburb just across the San Bernardino Freeway from Monterey Park, is on the verge of becoming the valley's second Chinese-majority suburb. Unlike Monterey Park, however, many of its new residents are poorer ethnic Chinese from Vietnam, working in local garment shops or in Alhambra's estimated 200 Chinese restaurants. ROC, Residents Opposing Condominiums, was Alhambra's son of ramp, organizing against the lower-income Chinese influx by circulating an initiative to ban all multiple-unit construction in the city. Meanwhile, Alhambra's aristocratic neighbor San Marino, former national headquarters of the John Birch Society, has used a bedroom ordinance to limit wealthy but large Asian families from buying into its old-money lifestyle. The young, 1989, Valley City of Diamond Bar, a slow-growth incorporation inspired, like Santa Clarita, by the homeowners' associations, has also intensely debated the limitation of apartment construction, presumably with the purpose of excluding working-class non-Anglos of all kinds. Indeed, the equation between apartments and crime is now so automatic in suburban consciousness that one recent Diamond Bar Council candidate, financed by the owner of the Carl's Jr. restaurant chain, argued thus against multifamily housing. "I don't want to see graffiti, gangs, and prostitution. I want safety for everyone who lives in Diamond Bar." It would be unfair, however, to suggest that the San Gabriel Valley is the only besieged white lager in Southern California. In northern San Diego and southern Orange counties, Southern California's 95% white futuropolis of affluent planned communities and science parks, hysterical homeowners associations, supported by local businessmen, have begun to wage war against the very immigrant labor upon which their master race lifestyles depend. Decrying such infamies as urination in public, homeowners in the city of Orange, Costa Mesa, San Clemente, Encinitas, and elsewhere along the Gold Coast have clamored for police crackdowns on street-corner labor markets and bush encampments of undocumented Mexican and Central American workers. Since there is virtually no low-income housing between the Santa Ana Barrio and East San Diego, a 90-mile distance, thousands of day laborers and their families, Spanish-speaking Okies of the 1980s, are forced to live furtively in hillside dugouts and impromptu brush camps, often within sight of million-dollar tract homes whose owners now want the immigrant blight removed. As these examples suggest, slow-growth know-nothingism by its very nature seems to be creeping toward Malthusian final solutions. Thus, at a 1987 conference of Not Yet New York, the West Side Slow Growth Alliance, one group advocated a statewide elbow room initiative that would seal the border with Mexico, drastically restrict immigration of all kinds, and impose obligatory family planning. The irony of the situation seemed to escape the initiative's sponsors, transfixed by their blinding vision of a politically cryogenized Aussie and Harriet lifestyle, that the definitive imposition of slow growth would require the construction of a California Reich. Friends of the People. It is a universal fact that where the value of land is the highest, civilization exhibits the greatest luxury side by side with the most piteous destitution. To see human beings in the most abject, the most helpless and hopeless condition, you must go not to the unfenced prairies, but to the great cities, where the ownership of a little patch of ground is a fortune. Henry George, 1869. In a famous passage of the 18th Brumaire, Marx depicted the French peasantry as a sack of potatoes. Constitutionally incapable of any large-scale coherence of interest or social action, except as mobilized by a charismatic leader. From our foregoing account, it is hard to avoid a similar judgment about Southern California homeowners. Try as hard as they might to become Sunbelt Bolsheviks, the slow growthers remain basically peasant potatoes, whose natural scale of protest is disaggregated nimbyism. Or would residential anarcho-syndicalism be a better term? What seems exceptional was the moment of focused mass energy represented by Proposition 13 and the Bonapartism of Howard Jarvis in 1978. Only the Hillside Federation, with its stable leadership and evolved program, breaks the mold of individualistic homeowners associations, dominated by cranky personalities, consorting in temporary coalitions and then inevitably remolecularizing around their own backyards. It seems, in historical perspective, virtually an iron law. Yet developers and the rest of the real estate industry live in fear that the improbable will again occur, and that some combination of crisis and charisma will place the slow growth equivalent of the Jarvis Amendment on the ballot. In order to forestall that particular 18th Brumaire, they have devised a brilliant, if staggeringly hypocritical strategy, based on their decades of expertise in manipulating public opinion against environmentalism. Following the prescription laid down by mega-developer Eli Broad in the early 1970s, they have become the friends of the people, denouncing selfish elitist homeowners who prevent the trickle-down of growth dividends and low-income housing to the bottom of society. The 1988 campaign against Slow Growth Measure A in Orange County was something of a déjà vu landmark in the history of special interest electioneering in California. Under the direction of New Right political consultant Lynn Wessel, Weasel to his opponents, a $2.5 million advertising onslaught financed by the Irvine and Mission Viejo companies was repackaged as a broad-based response by unions and minority groups. Pro-growth mailings in the blue-collar suburbs of northern Orange County falsely claimed that every household faced paying $1,800 tribute to some South County elitists. A few months later, Riverside County developers fighting yes on residence-controlling growth, Measure B, repeated the weasel strategy with Residents for Responsible Planning, depicted as a broad-based coalition with representation from organized labor, the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and affordable housing advocates. Although some building trades unions and minority groups did endorse this developer's front, the money, or at least 83% of it, came from the latifundistas, especially the 97,000-acre Rancho California company. If in both counties slow growth measures that early polls judged highly popular were defeated by scare tactics aimed at blue-collar voters, it was only the revival of an ancient ploy. Long before the weasel, the old SP octopus routinely bought elections in the name of popular anti-elitism. As in the early 1900s, moreover, the facade of populism dissimulates the operation of an ultra-elite power structure. In the contemporary case of a statewide alliance of developers, builders, realtors, and banks, opposed to growth controls. This newer, bigger octopus, as we saw in the last chapter, possesses extraordinary bipartisan leverage over both parties at all levels of government. Bleeding loudly about the plight of the proletariat and affordable housing, the pro-growth camp, led by the California Building Industry Foundation, comprises developers opposed to inclusionary housing, builders opposed to unions, realtors opposed to housing integration, and landlords opposed to rent control. While professing to be the cause of responsible planning, they have in fact sponsored a sweeping legal offensive, the second prong of their strategy, to reaffirm the untrammeled rights of private development against any communitarian regulation. Ominously, this initiative has found powerful philosophical allies in rightward-moving state and federal Supreme Court majorities, ready to restore 19th-century doctrines of absolute property. And, as in the bad old days at the beginning of the century, the labor and civil rights groups allied with the octopus are being led from behind. Minority groups, rightfully distrustful of white supremacist homeowners, have jumped from the frying pan into the fire to support developers responsible for the creation of the monochromatic suburban fringes in northern Los Angeles and southern Orange counties. Powerful building trades bosses, for the most part, continue to lock local labor federations, as in the city of Los Angeles, Riverside, San Bernardino, and Orange counties, into supine coalitions with big developers, even when the latter are major backers of union busting. One path-breaking exception to this dreary tradition was the 1988 initiative by the giant L.A. County Employees Local of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, to band together with environmentalists and Valley homeowners to oppose Mike Antonovich, the anti-union pro-growth supervisor for northern Los Angeles County. To legitimate their popular mandate, pro-growth forces regularly unveil polls to prove that inner-city residents and blue-collar workers are strongly opposed to the slow-growth movement. The Times interpreted one poll in a front-page story to allege that growth was the major new ethnic divide in the city, threatening to unravel Mayor Bradley's historic West Side-South Central coalition. In fact, the evidence is far more complex and ambiguous. Despite its demonization as the end of the boom, Black and Latino voters overwhelmingly endorsed Proposition U, and in other polls, 56% of Latinos and 40% of Blacks have indicated support for a slowdown of development. Other research from Orange County and across the country has failed to find a clear class polarization over growth issues. Possibly there is a significant internal divide in non-Anglo communities between renters and homeowners, with the latter more inclined toward slow growth. But the crucial point is that the polls themselves, by the exclusive way they frame questions, pro and contra economic development, for instance, simply reproduce the distorted dichotomies of growth war ideology. It is not surprising that poor people, especially renters, will choose jobs over environmental quality when the two are artificially counterposed. If it were the only choice offered, most people would also opt to cut their toe off rather than their leg. Such dubious but ubiquitous survey methods only reveal people's relative anxieties, not their substantive opinions. Like all ideology, slow growth and its pro-growth antipode must be understood as much from the standpoint of the questions absent as those posed. The debate between affluent homeowners and mega-developers is, after all, waged in the language of Alice in Wonderland, with both camps conspiring to preserve false opposites, growth versus neighborhood quality. It is symptomatic of the current distribution of power, favoring both capital and the residential upper-middle classes, that the appalling destruction and misery within Los Angeles's inner-city areas, see chapters 5 and 6, became the great non-issue during the 1980s, while the impact of growth upon affluent neighborhoods occupied center stage. The silent majority of non-affluent homeowners and renters have remained mere pawns in the growth power struggles. Their independent social interests, for instance, economic justice and environmental protection, jobs and clean air, and so on, suppressed in civic controversy. If the slow growth movement, in other words, has been explicitly a protest against the urbanization of suburbia, it is implicitly, in the long tradition of Los Angeles homeowner politics, a reassertion of social privilege. Ironically, at the very moment when the Anglo middle classes have demographically declined to a minority within the city, their organized social power waxes at a maximum, even if dispersed into NIMBY-type protests. Growth politics in general seem to militate against class politics. Yet, as we shall see in the next chapter, a one-sided class struggle, ironically uniting homeowners and developers, rages fiercely at the level of Los Angeles's built environment.